higher education is a process by which the human mind can not only form informed understandings of the world, but reach a state of mind such that it can reflect on those understandings. So you have knowledge, you have understanding, and you have critique. And unless all of those are going on, we're not, to my way of thinking, in the presence of higher education. Criticality has three moments. It has the abilities of critical thought. You have critical being, a critical person in the world with antennae in the world, which is sizing up the world all the time. And you have the ability to be critically active in the world. And you need all of those three to be a critical person in the world.
Hello and welcome to the Coconut Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Benjamin Freud, and today's guest is Professor Ronald Barnett. Ron has spent a lifetime in higher education as a scholar, institutional leader, manager, researcher, and writer. He's recognized as having introduced and developed the philosophy of higher education as a field in its own right, and he is the president of the recently established Philosophy and Theory of Higher Education Society and co-editor of two major book series. Since 1990, he's been at the staff of the education faculty at University College London, where he is now an emeritus professor. And over the years, he's written and edited more than 35 books and over 150 papers, and has been cited in the literature over 25,000 times. And he even says that there are about 3 million words of his in the public domain. And today he continues to act as a consultant to individual universities around the world on higher education matters, and also with his work in examining, reviewing, editing, and mentoring. And I'm so incredibly excited to share this conversation with you. You'll find out as you listen that Ron coined the phrase criticality, and specifically this conversation is about the difference between university and higher education, but more specifically what higher education is and how it exists beyond the institution. Check out our website, www.coconut-thinking.com. That's www.coconut-thinking.com. And I will leave space for my conversation with Ron. Well, hi, Ron. It's so lovely to see you. So lovely to have this conversation with you again. I so enjoyed the first time that we spoke. I'm really keen to hear about all your work and how your thinking has shifted over the years, and specifically going into this idea of higher education, what that might mean. But the first thing I'll do is ask you the question that we ask all our guests, which is, who are you and what story do you want to tell?
Well, thank you very much, Benjamin. My name is Ronald Barnett. I'm Emeritus Professor of Higher Education at University College London. I guess the main story I'd want to tell about myself on the intellectual academic side is that all my adult life I've been interested in higher education and the nature of universities. And as I picked up steam at the beginning of my intellectual life, I got into it in a fairly serious way. And this was back in the 1980s, when, frankly, there was very little serious scholarly work in the area, asking seriously the questions, what is higher education and what is a university? And in fact, I wrote both my master's thesis and my doctorate thesis in the areas. And my bibliographies at the back of those two theses were largely works themselves, works of fiction, because there was so little scholarly work in the field. So I've been carving out a path for myself over the last 40 years. But thankfully, over the last several years, I've been joined by others around the world. And a few of us, 7 or 8 years ago, established a new learned society, which we named the Philosophy and Theory of Higher Education Society, with abbreviation PATHES, P-A-T-H-E-S. And for my sins, I've been privileged to be the president of the society since its inauguration. But it's been very ably led, I might say, by others younger than myself. So I've been fascinated in the very questions as to what is a university and what is higher education. And in fact, in my work, I've distinguished those two questions very often in both in policy speak and in ordinary day language. Those two expressions, university and higher education, run together in the same phrase or used interchangeably. And I've tried to keep them separate. So each of my books has in its title either higher education or university, depending on what I've been interested in. For me, higher education is a certain kind and level of educational process or set of educational processes, whereas a university refers to a certain kind of institution in which higher education may or may not take place. And there are big issues arising all around the world as to concern with the philosophically with the nature of a university, not least as to what academic freedom is and what institutional autonomy is, and now as to how universities might respond to culture wars and so on and so forth. So I regard these matters as mega matters of our age. And indeed, they are global matters. Higher education is now a big business worth trillions of dollars across the world, with over 200 million students in it. And it's for my money, it warrants some very serious intellectual attention and thought. And that's itself is problematic in an age in which we are becoming more and more thoughtless.
So let's explore some of these concepts of higher education and university. We could probably put university to the side just for now, but you mentioned higher education as a process, and you also mentioned some of the markets and economies behind higher education and it being so worth so much from a dollar standpoint and profit. But let's go back to higher education itself. It's a process. What exactly do you mean by that? What might that look like? And can that happen outside universities? And I imagine you will say it will.
It can certainly happen outside the university. And that's partly why I want to distinguish higher education from university. Higher education is an educational process. And it could, in theory, certainly take place outside of even a formal institutional setting. We might hope that universities are sites where there's quite a lot of higher education going on, but that's a moot question. Are universities actually now sites of higher education, or are they not now simply sites of training, of skills acquisition, of the roboticization of learning, and the neglect of thought? So there are real problems, as I'm suggesting, about that relationship between universities and higher education. But to come to higher education then itself, I'd want to say in a nutshell that higher education is a process by which the human mind can not only form informed understandings of the world, but reach a state of mind such that it can reflect on those understandings and, put it in simple lay terms, be critical of those understandings. So you have knowledge, you have understanding, and you have critique. And unless all of those are going on, we're not, to my way of thinking, in the presence of higher education. That may sound simple, but actually it is, of course, a huge agenda, and it's a provocative and critical agenda in itself, because it's implicit, at least to some extent, in what I've already said, that for me there are grave issues around the world as to whether or not we're seeing this kind of education much present, and the extent to which it can be said to be flourishing. I have grave concerns with many that this kind of higher education is threatened around the world, because higher education has been incorporated into the machines of post-capitalism, and now artificial intelligence and the sheer management and complexity of running universities, so that there is a conspiracy, tacit conspiracy, such that the kind of criticality that I'm interested in is jeopardized and, in fact, is being neglected.
So you mentioned, from the university point of view, the robotization of university staff and the students. And what does that look like? Why has this been going on at that level?
It's been going on because there are mega interests which come together from different quarters, which are in favor of this rundown of thinking. Can I be forgiven for remarking and noticing that Mr. Trump in America has said that he loves the uneducated, and this is characteristic of conservative with a small c thinking that goes back hundreds of years, which has rather resisted the education of humanity in many ways and has only taken it on board where it's felt absolutely necessary for its own interests in running state and capitalist machines. So there are real issues here as to where the power lies so far as the structuring of higher education is concerned. As I've been remarking and accepting, that higher education is a form of education that we would hope to find in universities, but I'm saying it's under threat because of the combination of interests that are now imposing themselves on universities across the world. This varies, of course, to some extent from nation to nation, but nevertheless, in most situations across the world, you see a combination of corporate interests, particularly those of mega corporations in the private sector. You see state interests, and you see coming through the middle as a combination of both of those now, the use in universities and higher education of artificial intelligence and programming of learning that is from that stable. We've also seen over the last 40 to 50 years the emergence of mass higher education, and this is posing governments with huge challenges as to how they sustain, quotes, quality, while also achieving their ends of raising, quote, skill levels in their countries. All of these different interests from different quarters conspire together to, if not neglect, at least, or even repudiate thinking, at least reducing its scope. And we've seen this happening in all sorts of ways, which one can go into further.
So let's look into this further. Let's lift the bonnet. I can understand how a junior professor, an adjunct professor, might be directed to teach or not teach certain things, how there might be certain controls over what is said. And we certainly hear stories of people in universities who are ostracized or fired because of certain political stance they take, be it, you know, transgender or Gaza. But what are some of the more common, maybe perhaps insidious, but all those cases that might fly under the radar? And I'm particularly interested in, say, a professor who has tenure. How are they controlled and manipulated by the system?
Well, as I say, there's a tacit conspiracy at work here. And one of the interest groups that I didn't mention was that of the students. It's in the interest of everybody, the leaders and the managers, the professors and the lecturers, and the teaching staff generally, and the students, that the students get through their program of studies with as little disturbance as possible and secure their diplomas at the end of the day. It's in all of those groups' interest that that happens. And under those circumstances, the push is simply to get the students through, come what may. And so all around the world, whether we're talking about developing nations or advanced nations, we see, I hesitate to say, to use a phrase like degradation of standards. What we do see is a grade inflation. And we've certainly see it in a gross way in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, we classify degrees according to whether they're third class, second class, or first class. The second class is differentiated between an upper and a lower class. So in effect, you have four classes of degree, a first, a 2-1, a 2-2, and a 3. Now, 40, 50 years ago, less than 10% would have gained, probably 5% would have gained first, and another 15% would have gained an upper second. So you'd have had a situation, I'm just giving ballpark figures off the top of my head, a situation in which 20% of the cohort, a cohort, would gain what are called good degrees, i.e. first-class degrees or 2-1s. Now the situation is that 75% or so of students are gaining so-called first good degrees, first or 2-1s. It's a, and we understand that grade inflation through the profession pressures that are at work. As I say, yes, what I haven't also mentioned is, and this is where the power of the state comes in, that universities across the world are now audited. In America, you have there is a certain kinds of audit regimes, and you see them all around the world. The quality and audit processes themselves have become more intense around the world in higher education. But all of this runs together such that there are pressures on staff and institutions to get to get the students through. The students themselves have been given, not unreasonably, more and more leeway and more room to influence what's going on, and their evaluations count, even for professors who have tenure. All of this has to be coupled with, again, around the world, in every system, higher education around the world, greater pressures on universities simply to survive financially, institutionally, reputationally, and every other way. They're having to do more and more day by day with less and less, in broad terms. Staff over the last 30, 40 years, a global knowledge industry has grown up, such that staff are not only expected to publish papers in learned journals, but are expected to publish more and more. Their administrative duties have risen. Universities now expected to engage with the wider society, not unreasonably. As I say, staff are and professors are expected to get their students through their examinations. You put all of that together and you have a recipe for university educational systems which are simply intent on getting the students through. And the students, as I say, are party to this. Very often in many systems, not all by any means, but many systems students are paying in some way or other some sizable sums towards their education. And so they're expecting a return on their investment. And so, as I say, you have a conspiracy across a whole range of parties and working under considerable pressure to enable the students not only to emerge, but to emerge very often with good qualifications. Put all of that together, and the interest in, let's put it crudely, critical thinking disappears. That's not part of the game anymore. What the students want and what the state wants are, quotes, employability skills. And so the discourse of higher education now revolves around the terminology of skills, employability, and so on and so forth. And this has profoundly changed higher education. Not always for the worse, of course, not always at all. There are many beneficial aspects of the changes that I've just identified, but there are also very concerning changes at all as well, which I've begun to touch on. Crudely, as I say, the diminution of an interest in critical thinking in the way I want to understand the term critical thinking, and more broadly, thought itself. And a case in point is that of the chatbot phenomenon. And I'm sure many who might be watching, listening to this video, audio later on will be familiar or be aware of at least the chatbot phenomenon, which has come upon us very quickly and very recently. But it does mean that there's less incentive on students to use this stuff up here, Barnett points to his head, because now the chatbots will appear to do your thinking for you. So students can now outsource their own thinking to the chatbots.
I'm really curious about how this connects to K-12 education, which is connected itself and part of university life, because the students, the children, are groomed for university through certain myths that you have to go to university if you want to be successful, and that meritocratic trope. And I'm thinking, particularly in the US, there is this idea of the four C's, this desire to cultivate creativity, collaboration, communication, and critical thinking. I want to explore a little bit what your definition of critical thinking is. And by definition, I use the word loosely, but at least the concept, criticality. On this podcast, we've talked before about the fact that if there were really critical thinking, then the system would be sowing the seeds of its own destruction, because we would question so much that the whole thing would come toppling down with a little bit of a discourse and debate and seeing some of the gaps. But from your point of view, what is the critical thinking that schools pretend to teach, and what is the critical thinking or criticality that might be more pure in terms of human thought and discourse?
Thank you very much. I'm going to be modest and just mention that I coined the term criticality and put it into academic discourse, and it's been taken up across the world. I only mention that because I coined the term criticality quite deliberately, as it were, as a kind of rebuke to the way in which the phrase critical thinking was being used. Even when I coined the term 15 years ago, it seemed to me that critical thinking was then, although it was a term in use, was itself being narrowed and diminished, and its force lost sight of. So what do I mean by critical thinking? I'll come at that in two ways. I'll come at it in a rather prosaic way to begin with. A question to be asked of anybody who's interested in critical thinking is this: give me your idea of the critical thinker in quotes real life, what would the critical thinker look like? How would you recognize a critical thinker? Who is fully a critical thinker? Well, here's one way of identifying such a person. Take a health setting, a hospital, say, and imagine you have a doctor in it or a very senior experienced nurse. And she or he, after many years of experience, begins to become aware of something that's going awry in the practices of the hospital, something pretty major. Perhaps they even notice that some children are dying, or patients are dying in a certain way, in a certain situation, and nobody else noticed it. And they start to look into it privately, and they begin to form a theory as to what's going on. And they realize that some practices are going awry. And they start to think about, well, what's to be done about all of this? And they start to raise the issue with other people around them. And they get blocked. And they're told, there's no problem here. These incidents are just that. And so they start to do more work. They start to look around. They look at other practices in other hospitals in the world. They wise themselves up even more on global standards in that particular area. And they become more and more informed. And they start to wage, if necessary, a one-person campaign in that setting and take it up with the authorities, knowing that to do so may be injurious to their careers. Now, that is an example to me of criticality in action. Colloquially, we term that situation a situation in which a whistleblower, I don't know if you have that term very much in the USA, but it's a term for a situation in which a whistleblower blows the whistle on malpractice in a institutional setting. Now, in order to do that, what do you need? Well, you need, first of all, the capacity to set your own practices in a wide context. You have to have in that situation, have a wide understanding of health practices. You have to have a wide understanding of the structure of a health system in a country, and so on and so forth. So you're taken out of the immediate situation, you have the cognitive capacity to size up a situation in which you're in the widest possible way, and to bring those perspectives to bear on the situation such that you're able to critique the situation that you're in. So, for example, you might have a concept of health, or you might have a concept of public health or health care. And you look around you and you find that your concepts are not being reflected in what you see around you. So you've got cognitive capacities. You've got a kind of being in the world, which itself is critical. You have critical stances in relation to what you're seeing and feeling in the world. And you have the capacity now to act critically in the world, with all the problems and opprobrium that's going to come your way. So criticality has three moments. It has the abilities of critical thought. I won't use the word term critical thinking, that's far too narrow, but critical thought, which is very expansive. You have critical being, a critical person in the world with antennae in the world, which is sizing up the world all the time. And you have the ability to be critically active in the world. So you have those three components: critical thought, critical being, and critical action. And you need all of those three to be a critical person in the world. Now, higher education gets nowhere near that. by and large, even in professional settings, professional education. But that's my idea of critical thinking. And if it seems to me, if we're not doing that in higher education, we're not seriously interested in critical thinking.
I wonder where values and ethics and ontologies come into play. If we think of the Frankfurt School, they're known for having been Marxist. Now, that was way back in time when Marxism perhaps had a few more adherence to it, but there was that sense of value, that sense of not just the content and the action, but also driven by a desire to rectify injustice. And Horkheimer and Adorno speak of that constantly, or write of that. Where do values and ethics and ontologies come into play?
Well, absolutely crucial. It follows from what I'm saying that the critical thinker is disposed to try to help the world to be a better place, and is using the conceptual frameworks and ideas that they have to address the world and see, to put it in the language of 1930s Frankfurt School, to see the gaps there are between big concepts, democracy, health, education, and the way the world is, in order to see the gaps that there are and then to help to move things on to improve matters. So the ethical component is absolutely core here. It's kind of almost a platform, a base, a foundation on which this criticality has its momentum and can move forward, because one is disposed to be trying to, because one is, first of all, one starts off with a sense that the world is not what it could and should be, and one is disposed to try to use one's limited resources to make it a better place.
But so as I listen to you, I am reminded that in very few high schools, in very few secondary institutions, and in very few universities, is it compulsory to take a course on ethics. It might be the foundation, but there's never this. On the contrary, we're always told, avoid bias, try to be as objective as possible, when actually there's nothing that we could do in ethics to be unbiased. And we should embrace that bias because that's our North Star. It seems that there's this trope that exists, but also structures where there simply isn't discussion about ethics.
Yeah, I quite agree. And it is, of course, a big issue. It's been an issue in social theory and philosophy in a Marx way for nearly 100 years, as to the way in which values can or should not come into play in our understandings of the world. My sense is that over the last 30, 40 years, there's been a greater acceptance that it's legitimate to bring values into play in understanding the world. And some go even further and say that values are inherent in the world itself. I only say that to observe that there are different positions here in a very complex field of the relationship of values to understanding the world and to acting the world. But I'm absolutely clear that values are crucial in understanding the world. I'm very interested in, if I can just leap on for a moment, to what I've termed the ecological university. What do I mean by the ecological university? I mean a university that is sensitive to the way in which it is situated in the world, in the totality of the world being understood partly as composed of mega ecosystems. And the university is not only subject to these mega ecosystems of knowledge, of learning, of culture, of the economy, of the state, a society, and so forth, but is a player in all of these ecosystems. But what I observe is that these ecosystems are characteristically malformed. They are impoverished in various ways. They have run into difficulty. You've only got to look at the world of nature and the ecological crises that we're faced with. Now, to talk of nature as being constituted by or as presenting to us crises is itself to impart and inject values into our understanding of the world. So I'm with those who are relatively relaxed about saying that values can quite legitimately come into our appropriations of our representations and our understandings of the world. And in fact, I've just recently written a paper which has just been published on precisely this matter of crises in higher education. And one of the questions there is as to whether or not the crises are really real in the world, or whether they're simply, as it were, figments of our imagination that we impose on the world. Well, I want to say that there are crises in the world, and the world, in a way, has values written into it, and we can legitimately engage with the world in that way of identifying problems which are value problems which are in the world, and they're not just figments of our imagination.
Listen, Ronald, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your insights and how you push the conversation to provoke thinking.
Okay. And thank you very much.
This has been the Coconut Thinking Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Check out our website, www.coconut-thinking.com. That's www.coconut-thinking.com. And we are also on Intrepid Ed News, www.intrepidednews.com. Leave us 5 stars, subscribe, tell your friends, and as always, leave us a comment. Speak to you soon. Bye-bye.